I just went a bit too long on the finish line tabletop, which was a pretty big jump, and I kind of like landed into a bump at the bottom of the landing and broke tibia, fibia in both legs, both ankles, both knees. It's really hard psychologically to, you know, be pushing along in the desert, see someone, deal with that situation, see them in pain, jump back on the bike and just start hooking in again, doing exactly what it was that just hurt your mate. Like, for me, I know what I went through to get it, and for that reason, they're pretty special for sure.
Hello there, and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, helping you save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Now, today's guest is an off-road biking legend, a two-time Dakar winner. And let's just put this into perspective, perhaps, right? Talking to you as an ex-footballer, he's talking to us today with three broken vertebrae. That's a broken back. You stub your toe and you want 3 weeks off training. So this is a proper tough man, the absolute legend. Let's welcome Sam Sunderland. Morning, Sam.
Morning, guys. Thanks for having me on.
No, Sam. I mean, the pleasure literally is all ours, mate. The fact that you've come on in the recuperative state that you're in, we're going to get onto that in just a second. I mean, to speak to a two-time Dakar Rally champion is an honour, a truly, truly tough competitor. Talk us through the three broken vertebrae, please. How, why, when, what's the story? And most importantly, how are you feeling right now?
Yeah, play stupid games, win stupid prizes, right? It's always the same thing. I'm feeling all right. A bit sore. It's only 3 days ago, actually. I was over in Osgore, kind of southwest coast of France, riding in the sand because I was planning on racing the 2K. So, Yeah, I had the Triumph over there with a few mates, putting some laps in and just ran out of talent a bit quick through some bumps and landed clean on my head. Tripped to the hospital, three broken vertebrae, and a five-hour drive back to Andorra, and here I am. Got me coffee and chatting to you boys. So.
Wow. I mean, honestly, Sam, we've spoken to some legends here on the podcast, you know, TT riders, people have had bad accidents and come back from it. You made a different stuff, you riders, because to say you broke your back literally 3 days ago, and you look very fit, sat there, all, you know, all right, happy. And
took me thing off, you know, it was just for the camera.
Well, you can wear that if you want. I mean, it didn't do, what's his name, Avid Merian any harm, did it? Lou Fox is when you used that character. But seriously, we obviously wish you a speedy recovery. Now, I know your backstory, but for those who don't, I think we actually started off on two wheels of the same type, because I used to do BMX racing way before you were born. But your love affair for two wheels, it wasn't with an engine to start with, was it?
No. I guess everyone has kind of been struck with the bike bug. It's kind of like, if I try and think back to like your first memory, it would be like, I guess, that freedom of you on your BMX riding off to your mate's house, not needing your mum and dad to drop you off anywhere. Like, that sense of freedom sort of sticks with you from, you know, from when you first have that feeling when you're off on your Todd. And yeah, it kind of just sort of stuck with me my whole life, really, and mixed with like always like competing and racing, you know, race people across the road when you're a kid. And yeah, kind of all mixed in together, I ended up racing rally. So,
Sam, when Ewan and I were talking before we came on today and the days leading up to it and swapping stories about what we'd researched about you, you look at where you are now, and this seems relatively small fry to what happened back when you were 16. If you don't mind me asking about that, because maybe that's why you were that we've got a man here sat with ostensibly a broken back that kind of says, here's my coffee, let's crack on. When at 16, Sam, you were in a position where you'd really done yourself some serious harm, hadn't you?
Yeah, so I grew up there on the south coast, and they had Matcham's Park. I don't know if you ever remember it. It was they actually had a couple of motocross Grand Prix there. It was really cool facility, and pretty sad it's been closed down. But like, that was my local sort of motocross track. And yeah, they had the GP there on the Saturday, Sunday. And then Monday, they like let a few of the locals go and ride the track, but it was still pretty rough from the weekend and all like the peaky jumps that they'd make for the GP boys. And I just went a bit too long on the finish line tabletop, which was a pretty big jump. And I kind of like landed into a bump at the bottom of the landing and broke tibia, fibia in both legs, both ankles, both knees. And had like hairline fractures in my pelvis and all up through from the compression. And yeah, 6 months trip in a wheelchair. I did my GCSEs actually as I was 16. It was GCSE time. And like my table was up on picks. And yeah, luckily the motorbike thing worked out because the GCSEs wouldn't have got me far.
I was going to say, you've got every excuse here to hide a calculator, loads of notes. You got, you know, I remember trying to cheat in exams. You can't take anything. You've got a wheelchair you could hide stuff in. But I think it's a testament to your personality, though. You imagine most 16-year-olds at a really, really crucial part in your life that happens. Another opportunity opens for you because you go and visit your auntie and uncle in Dubai, and instead of sort of feeling sorry for yourself, you think, hang on a minute, maybe there's another form of bike racing that could suit me. And that's where the real journey started, didn't it? When you were recovering from that injuries, a door opened.
Yeah, I can't, like, to be honest, at that, like there was a bit of a gap because that was like 16, and then it was probably a couple of years later when I went over to Dubai. But I'd actually, like, it's true what you say, but at the time it didn't feel like that. Like I was pretty down in the dumps and kind of like in that moment of my career, I was like chasing the motocross dream, and I'd just sort of come good on a 125 and signed for a team and was like looking forward to that motocross sort of dream that I'd always had. And that kind of like took the wind out of the sails, spending in, you know, 6 months in a wheelchair and a year off the bike. And I was actually one of my sponsors at the time, Meridian Lifts. They gave me a job as a lift engineer, so I started doing my apprenticeship, and like the motocross dream had kind of like shattered, let's say. And I was still riding a bit with my mates on the weekend, but you know what it's like when you got the 9 to 5 and, you know, just ride when you can. And it's always a bit of graft, isn't it, to go riding and wash the bike and all that. So I'd kind of given up on that dream in some way. And as you say, I went there just on holiday to visit my auntie and uncle in Dubai, and both my little cousins ride. So I took my kit out and went to the local track, and KTM dealership guy was there and saw me ride and was like, hey, like, you ride really well, maybe you could work in the showroom and sell bikes and then race the motocross series here on the weekend. And I was like, that sounds like dreamboat, you know, like I was a lift engineer sweeping the shit out of the bottom of the lift pit during the week. So I was ripped his hand off at the chance. And to be honest, I was a pretty rubbish salesman. I think I sold like 2 bikes in that 6 month period. I was just busy trying to ride them all the time. Yeah, raced all the local motocross championship, and they actually had a desert championship that I started racing out there too, which was pretty cool because it kind of like fit my riding style. Like it was a 25K loop in the dunes and you do like 6-7 laps. And as you start to remember bits of the lap, you go faster, faster, faster. So I raced that. Then the first round of the world championships was Abu Dhabi Desert Challenge, which was like the official 5-day rally. And if I'm honest, at the time, I looked at those guys a bit like adventurers, you know. I was still like a young motocross guy, like thinking I was a cool kid throwing whips in the dunes and stuff. Then the guys asked me, the team I was working for, that shop I was working for, KTM dealer, they asked me if I want to race Abu Dhabi. And I'm like, like as I said, I thought those guys were like the adventure guys of the desert, and they weren't cool kid enough for me at the time, or whoever I thought I was, who knows, some sort of Ricky Carmichael wannabe. And so I end up racing it, and I'm on like basically a standard EXC 450 with big tanks slapped on. And the first time I rode the bike was like in the car park the night before the prologue. And I've got stock suspension with like these 30 litre tanks on there. And all the factory boys are there, Coma and Dupre, and I was like, this is, I'm going to show these fools what's up, you know. Like I was so confident, stupidly in some way at the time, but I knew how to ride in the dunes, and that race was like all dunes. So I raced, I won one stage by 19 minutes and 50 seconds a second, and then another one by like 9-10 minutes. And at the time, I didn't really think much of it. I was just like out there sort of sending it, having fun. And then after that race, I had like a factory HRC contract offer. And I was like, what's all that about? Like, what am I going to do now? Like, I had this motocross dream I still thought I was chasing. And this was kind of like a one-off thing I did on the side. Who's, you know, I think I was 20 at the time. Who's going to turn down, you know, a HRC contract? It was like things I'd only heard of at the time. And before I knew it, I was off to Tokyo there at HRC, with all the white uniform on there. Converse getting my phone to go and see their new rally bike. And that was it. Life had took a bit of a turn, you know?
I mean, it strikes me as that's your natural disposition, Sam. That sense of almost kind of wide-eyed matter-of-factness about it. About you had quite a steadfast dream in one sense, and with what it sounds like, fell into something else that you're exceptionally good at right from the start. I mean, that sense of riding in the sand of what the dunes are, given where we all are geographically and what England's like. You don't get that many vast deserts or sand dunes on this part of the world, do you? So how come a boy from the South Coast, admittedly it's a lot warmer down there than it is up north where I am, how come a boy from the South Coast felt so at home pretty much straight away in just oceans of sand?
I mean, I definitely, you know, I can list off plenty of crashes and speed adjustment, shall we say, where like I remember like, you know, as you say, in the UK you start your bike up, your neighbors complaining about the noise, you ride on the local moor and there's some special lizards that need saving all of a sudden. So like in the UK you're pretty restricted, and like that, going back to that same thing that I said, like when you're on your BMX and you can just leave and you don't need your mum or your dad to drop you off, I had that same feeling when I first got in the dunes out there. Like the boys were like, I remember we went for a desert ride and they're like, got all the bikes off, got kitted up. So I'm like, where can we go then? And like, wherever you want. And that amazing feeling of like, what are you talking about? Like, we could just ride wherever we want. Like that filled me up. And I think, you know, there's a couple of books I read. There's one called Bounce, which is like 10,000 hour rule. Like, I don't think there's such a thing as talent. You're not born with talent, it's earned. And it, that Bounce book's basically about the 10,000 hour rule. It's about ping pong players. So it's like, if you can accumulate 10,000 hours, you at like proper practice, you will become almost certain that you will become a professional level in whichever sport it is. But it's one thing to say it, and then it's like to have the passion to commit to doing it and overcoming all the injuries along the way and bike prep and getting yourself out there again, going when it's bad weather, going when you don't feel like it. Like, you need a huge amount of passion for whatever sport it is you're doing to accumulate that 10,000 hours. And that was sort of what made sense to me, or what I took from that book. And I just loved riding in the desert.
I've got to jump in. 10,000 hours, 100,000 hours. I'm going to have to slightly disagree there. I totally get it with the hard work, but you definitely have got a God-given talent. You must have. You can give me all the hours God has got, and I would not be like you on a motorbike. So I think you're very humble there. But when you went out there and you did your first race and you smashed the pros, then you got the contract, that must have been a pinch me kind of moment. But did you ever dream you'd go on to do the Dakar? I mean, seriously, anyone who does a Dakar on four wheels, I've got huge respect for. But for two wheels, you know, we talk to road racers, and to a certain degree, you can learn the corners, you can know the routes, you can know where it's windy, where it's not. But
well, like the TT, you and Dirk, we've spoken about the TT. Yes, I mean, it's ridiculously hard, but nobody's moving the road, are they?
Exactly. You know, it's a massive amount of skill level and research and prep goes into being a TT rider. But what you do for the Dakar, it's forever changing. The scenery will change, the dunes. I mean, that takes some big kahunas and also a huge amount of talent. You've won it twice. I mean, do you still have to pinch yourself to think, you know, the boy from Poole has done good?
Yeah, no, like them TT boys are absolute badasses, and I got so much respect.
Oh, yeah.
I really want to get over and watch it because I see all the videos of the flybys. But I actually met with McGuinness a few times, and I got a couple of mates that I I know that race it. David Todd actually just moved over here to Andorra. So like,
we've had him on the show. He's a great guy. Yeah.
I got like so much respect for them, but like, it's also true that like the desert's different. It's just a different discipline, and you need to be stupid enough to go faster, as fast as that anywhere. And the desert is always new and is always coming at you. But like, I mean, there definitely, like, as you say, there was a bit of a pinch me moment when I was off on the plane to Japan after just signing this HRC contract at like 20 years old, and like thinking that dream was gone of ever becoming something as a rider, you know, like when I broke my legs there. And it was really cool. I remember like having a little moment in the airport phoning mom and dad and being like, oh, this is so cool. And yeah, like, and then it's hard because nothing's given, you know, like when you sign the contract, you just get like an opportunity then. So it comes with expectation and pressure, and we've all got, you know, whoever you are, you've all got pressure, if it's from yourself or from external. But like, it quickly became serious, and like, like, I've signed a contract now, I'm being paid to do this, I need to win. Job. Yeah, like, it's a job, and my job now is to win. And I was always, it never bothered me too much because I always wanted to win more than I felt that like external pressure of winning. But like, it was definitely something I was aware of. But like, no, for sure, it's dream boat. And you know, even now, like, my Dakar trophy is in the corner of the room there, but like, when I look at them, they're pretty special, you know. Like, if I come and plonked them on your lounge floor, you'd be like, oh yeah, that's cool, it's a Dakar trophy. But like, for me, I know what I went through to get it, and for that reason, they're pretty special, for sure.
You talk about what you go through. There's a sense of, given the vast, wide open spaces, given, like you say, the adventure of what the Dakar... Just incidentally, the Dakar, not in the Dakar. Am I being silly? Since when has it not been in Dakar? And Saudi Arabia is obviously the latest position for it.
2008, with the terrorist threats, it went to South America. And the year I first won was 17, and we did Paraguay. We started in Paraguay, into Bolivia, and then down into Argentina, and then 22 was in Saudi.
The kind of places you want to visit, but not tearing along at 100 miles an hour through the, you know, you don't get a chance to do much sightseeing, do you? You're just literally hanging on.
It's like Indiana Jones on a bike, isn't it? It just conjures up that sense of that adventure of where you could possibly go. And the question I was going to ask before the geographical one, Sam, was, There's a sense of, because of where these races take place, because of the extreme conditions, and yes, you are racing, yes, it's inherently competitive, there does appear to be quite a sense of camaraderie amongst the riders, because let's be honest, the vast distances that you go, and you're not doing laps of a track where if things go not quite to plan, then you're not too far away from base or HQ. If it goes wrong in the desert, are you looking around going, well, hopefully someone's going to stop and help me, because otherwise it's a mighty long walk to the next place.
Yeah, that's it. Like, there is a really good sort of camaraderie amongst the riders. And, you know, because as you say, like, whoever you might be eyeballing at the start, like, and beating your dog, like, he might be saving your life in 10 minutes down the road. Because, yeah, they got helicopters, but it's normally like 30, 40 minutes till they arrive, and normally in that time other riders will get to you. So
and that happened, didn't it, Sam? And you saved a colleague at the time, didn't you? You know, a fellow rider was hurt, and you stopped, didn't you? I mean, what goes through your mind in that situation? I'm assuming you can't be selfish and think, well, the clock is rolling, I need to win this stage. You stop and you help your fellow man.
Yeah, exactly. Like, in any way, in them moments, like, the safety of someone else trumps it, you know. But also, we're obliged to stop, and we get our time back. Like, we're tracked constantly by GPS. But as you say, it's really hard psychologically to, you know, be pushing along in the desert, see someone deal with that situation, see them in pain, and then excuse me, jump back on the bike and just start hooking in again, doing exactly what it was that just hurt your mate. Like, I mean, I've picked up, I don't know, probably four or five guys over my career. But like, I know a story from Pricey. He was the first guy there when Gonzalez had his accident and passed away. you know, dealt with that whole thing for an hour or so, then jumped on his bike again and start sending it in the desert. He finished third that Dakar. And it's just like it definitely brings like the risk of it in the forefront of your mind, because as you know, like when you're locked in riding, you're so hyper focused and you haven't got time to think about them other things. But then when you deal with a situation like that, you're forced to like come out of that focus racing mode and deal with the situation and hop back into it. It's like, it's pretty heavy.
That's why you guys are so skilled at what you do. And I meant it about the 10,000 hours. Yeah, you can train for stuff, but you can't train for those situations, can you? It's natural instinct. It's human nature to stop and to help. And, you know, it's dangerous at what you do. But I want to ask you about something else that you volunteer to do.
Speaking of danger.
Speaking of things that are very dangerous. If nobody's seen this on YouTube, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, the motorcycle stunt you did in Dubai, which finished with you standing on the high. Honestly, I had sweaty palms watching that. I mean, tell us about that. And obviously, it was amazing bit of videography for YouTube. I absolutely loved the Red Bull video you did. But how on earth did you have the guts to stand? Because I know you say, "Oh my God, this is really sketchy. I'm not a scared kind of guy, but this is scary." I was scared watching you stand up there.
Yeah, like, I mean, I got super, like, Red Bull helped me out to get that project done. And, like, those kind of things are so cool, like, to be able to link the two to riding in some way. Like, first moving over there, being a salesman in a showroom, and, you know, I'd finish it zero pennies in my bank account each month. And, you know, a few years later in some motorbike races down the road, and I'm now stood on top of this iconic building. Like, it's a really cool, like, in my own sort of head, it's like a cool process to go through. And like, I remember it's quite funny because loads of people were like, "Oh, you stood on top of the Burj," but I'm like, "Yeah, no, but there's a sick video in the build up to it." But like, only anyone ever talks about that one moment. Meanwhile, I was like absolutely risking it, sending it in the dunes and stuff. But no, like, it was such a cool opportunity, and it was almost too exciting to let the fear ruin it, if that makes sense. Like, It was humming and hawing if I was going to be able to go up there or not all week, because obviously you need all the permissions from all the, you know, the top dogs in the country. And I think only like 5 or 6 people that have been up there are way more famous than anything I've ever done. So like, wasn't really sure I was going to go up there. And anyway, we got the green light and we left at like 3 a.m. and I was climbing ladders for like, because the lift stopped at like the 200 something floor. And then you just got ladders up the spiral. And I had to carry all my kit up there. And I had these two big like riggers with me and we're climbing. And after like 40 minutes, I see them start slacking behind. So I'm like, "Hey, like, give me the bags, dude. I'll carry my own stuff." And we got up there and I was like Billy Big Balls on the ladder climbing. And it's getting smaller and smaller. And they like open the hatch at the top. I looked over the edge and I'm like, "Not a chance, dude. Like, close that hatch and let's get down." Like, it was terrifying. And the thing moves 3 meters.
Oh, like, stop.
And you can feel it moving. Like, if one of the boys like moves quick, it goes like, "Doing," and you're like, no.
What I couldn't get my head around, right? I'm assuming you filmed it in order. How can you concentrate, you know, riding through the moor, you know, doing jumps through the golf course and all that kind of stuff? Because in my head, I was thinking, "Oh, this is good fun. But at the end of this, I've got to climb that building." I mean, I wouldn't have been able to concentrate on anything that week. I mean, was it in the back of your mind all week that this is going to finish with me doing a wicked stunt, which no one gets the opportunity to do, really? And if they do, they're going to have to be brave, because honestly, I'm sweating just thinking back to watching the video.
Like, it was so... It was weird because obviously that it was an 8-day shoot from like 4 a.m. till 6 p.m. And it was 2 weeks before start of Dakar 22. And I went straight from that 8-day shoot to a week test with the team, 3 days home, and then race Dakar. So I had like a bit of pressure on from some of the partners being like, "Hey, it's not good. You're tiring yourself out doing this video shoot just before Dakar. Like, what's your goal here?" And anyway, managed to win 22 Dakar. So it was like, right, managed to not get any drama from that side. But in the build up during the shoot, Red Bull and the guys like kind of kept it a bit secret from me that we were going to get permission or not. Like, they more or less let me understand that we weren't going up there. So I was busy. Like, imagine to ride your bike on a golf course there in Dubai is like dreaming. Yeah. Like, it was something that I'd always wanted to do. So I was already having like mad fun. So then on that, like the night before, they were like, right, set your alarm for 3 a.m. We're climbing the bush. And I'm like, I was so excited for it, you know?
I mean, I echo what you're saying, you, and to watch it brings me out in a cold sweat. And just to think that is something that you did, Sam, and the way that you talk about it, it's astonishing, really. Let's get a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping just to bring the heart rate down a little bit. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. So that ends up being at the top of the world, on the Burj in Dubai, looking down at all you kind of can survey, Sam. Let's rewind back to when you actually passed your bike test. Well, I mean, was that feeling anywhere near as exhilarating as being stood atop one of, if not the tallest building on the planet?
Definitely not. I actually did my bike test. I did my CBT there in the UK back along to get a little scooter. And then for that Abu Dhabi Desert Challenge that, you know, my first one that I explained before, I had to get my real bike license. And I was living in Dubai at the time, and I went down to the local learning center. And obviously I knew how to ride. Obviously everyone thinks they know how to ride, right? When they go for their bike test, look at me. But I was doing it with like a heap of delivery drivers that were trying
this
to do their
ridiculous.
Indian delivery drivers doing their license in Dubai. And I remember a funny moment, it was emergency stop day. Like, we had to practice emergency stop. Anyway, first bloke, we all got all knee and arm protectors on. First bloke tucks the front, puddle of fuel under the bike. And then the instructor was like, it was like his day to let us understand how dangerous riding motorbikes were. So he doesn't warn everyone and be like, hey guys, there's a puddle of fuel now, so let's move 3 meters to the right and we'll continue the emergency stop. You just let everyone go down like dominoes, bam, like emergency stopping into the fuel.
Just stood there with his clipboard going fail,
yeah, like uniform
fail.
And a whistle
fail,
yeah, and I remember lining up on the edge of the thing. I'm like, dude, I'm not doing an emergency stop into the fuel.
No one's going to stop in fuel.
Wow.
Yeah. But anyway, managed to get my license, and that was, definitely a bit not as exciting as stood on a building, for sure.
Sam, that's amazing. That sense of, right, I need to get this past. Why I'm racing in the desert tomorrow. Not because I've got to get out on the road to kind of do very kind of low impacts. No, because I've got to go and terrorize through the desert in the next couple of days. So if we get this boxed off, that'd be great. And there must watching you going, well, this geezer obviously knows how to ride a motorcycle.
Yeah, they didn't feel like that. But it was funny. Like, now there's some. I mean, there's a Red Bull UK athlete, Arvid, that just signed for Verstappen's teammate. I don't think he's got his driving license. We were at the Red Bull Athlete Summit a year or so ago, and I remember him talking to him. And it's just mad to think he's racing alongside Verstappen and he's got no driver's license.
Crazy. Sam, every time you talk about being on a bike, your face lights up. Am I right to assume you ride for pleasure as well, or do sponsors not allow that? Do you ride on the road, or is that too dangerous?
Every time I ride a bike is for pleasure. Like, I try to do it as little as possible for work, let's say. But I mean, I have done a few track days in my time, but if I'm honest, riding on the road too much for pleasure, I can't trust myself. Like, we've all got that itch, and you start playing and wheeling and backing it in next to your mate just for a bit of crack. And I mean, we're all just boys that like riding bikes at the end of the day, and I'm the same. So I have to keep myself on a bit of a rein, but I've done a few track days, and I love watching MotoGP, so I'm friends with a few of them boys.
You said earlier on, Sam, there's a phrase that you use about being filled up by being sat on a motorbike. Is that what it means to you? Without needing to try and quantify it, you sound at your most happiest sat there in the saddle. Is that what it is in a nutshell?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I've done for so long, like, that it's hard to imagine it being any other way. And there's obviously differences, like when you're racing for a factory team and you've got the pressure and the expectation, but it's also something that you've worked towards and built up towards. So you've also got that same sort of vibe. And, you know, when in the summer here, every day I'm more or less on the trials bike out with the boys, like, we don't ride trial sections. We just do like a 3-hour loop, crash a load. It's an open face helmet, so you all laugh at each other and stop off for a few brewskis on the way home. And it's just so much fun. And I feel like on your bike, you've not got too many other worries, or maybe you've not got enough space in your brain to put too much energy on your other worries, because let's face it, whoever you are, you got worries. If you're, you know, Donald Trump, or you're, you know, the bin man, everyone's got their own worries, and they're all real to themselves, you know.
It sounds to me, I've got plenty of mates who absolutely hate their jobs. They go to work, they live for the weekends. It sounds to me like your life is one big weekend, and I mean that with respect, but you are making a living out of something that just brings you joy, and it sounds like you are genuinely living the dream.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely feel really fortunate, and I mean, on the flip side, it was a bit of graft, and I've been through plenty of ups and downs on the way, like it, and I think that makes it all that much special, because, you know, I worked the 9-to-5, I was a lift engineer, I went through all the injuries and ups and downs and disappointments, and it's I appreciate it really a lot, my life, and yeah, it's something that's, you know, hopefully I can let the kids see, and that they'll also enjoy similar things one day.
It's a great example to set, Sam. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, because as you say, given where you managed to work your life into at this stage, lovely family, the ability to do what you want most days, obviously in and around your competitive spirit as well, coming back from this injury, which we obviously wish you all the very, very best with, that you're back up on a bike competing as soon as possible. But the context that you put, the perspective that you put is absolutely right. You've worked your socks off to get there, haven't you? Mentally, physically, it's taken its toll. But that attitude of one step forward, keep going, It's such a motivating and inspiring thing for you to say, mate. So it's been a pleasure to be able to chat. And going off the back of what Ewan just said there about it seeming like every day is a Saturday for you, being able to go out and crack on doing the bits and bobs that you do, we finish every podcast with asking our guests, our wonderful guests, of which you have been one of the most wonderful, about a fantasy ride. So we need to know right now, where in the world you'd be riding, what you'd be going on this ride on from a motorbike point of view, who you'd be riding with, and whether you'd be listening to any music on this specific ride. But given what we've heard from you so far, idyllic seems to sum up your life. So can you think of something even more idyllic to finish the show with?
Yeah, I think riding bikes is always about who you go with, right? Because when you go on your own, it was only as good as the stories you're telling your mates. So like, it's always nice to share them with people. And I see, what's his name? I can picture him. Mark Webber rides a lot. Yeah. He rides a lot of adventure stuff. It would have to be adventure stuff because, you know, I've done enough competing. My pleasure comes more now from taking my time and seeing the sights and hearing the stories of whoever it is you meet in that fuel station. Those are things that sort of fulfill the trip. I'd probably be on the Tiger 1200. I've been riding one a bit the last couple of months, and plenty of spaces for me sandwiches and bits and bobs to park up overnight. And the place, I would say, I'd like to ride New Zealand. I've always seen plenty of crazy New Zealand or South America. Like, South America is so cool and such a contrast in mountains. You know, like that Dakar race, we were at 4,000 meters in Bolivia in La Paz, and you know, the same afternoon we dropped down into Argentina. We're 45 degrees in the dunes, and it was -6 in Bolivia. So like, there's such a huge contrast of sites and volcanoes and open plains that that's a cool place to ride, but I've been there before. So I think New Zealand would be cool. Have I ticked all the boxes? Music.
Any music? Yeah, cool.
Yeah. I mean, as I say, I think part of it's the sharing. So like having a good cardo system on there to have a bit of banter with the boys along the way, but depends if I got sick of hearing them, I'd put some music on. I think reggae would fit pretty well. I quite like reggae.
Wow.
Depending on which type of reggae, but yeah, kind of like floats the boat as you're cruising along through the valley. So
we've not had New Zealand or reggae music before. That is definitely a first. And I tell you what, you've been first class, honestly, Sam. You have lit up my screen like that beaming smile of yours, and to remind myself, you're sat there with a broken back
and you've been full of pleasure, joy, and enthusiasm. Honestly, props. What a guest. It's been amazing.
Amazing.
Thank you very much, mate. Appreciate it. Been a pleasure to speak to you boys too.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you, Sam, but sadly, that's about it for this week's Full Chat powered by Bikeshores, the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. Bikeshore will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance and so much more.
As ever, I've just got to say, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much to today's very special guest. Please rest up after this and get better soon. The wonderful Sam Sunderland.
Thank you very much, mate. Cheers.
It's been a pleasure. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
And from Dave and myself, as ever, thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, see you later.